Hello, this is the latest in my series of very occasional podcasts in which I interview people whose work I'm interested in and admire. I'm sorry they've been a lot more occasional than I originally intended, but hopefully you enjoyed the first one I did. Last September, I think it was, with Phil Jewett, Senior Communications Officer with Leeds City Council. This podcast is an interview I did with Tom Murta. Tom retired in 2012 as Chief Executive of Midland Heart Housing Association after a distinguished career in the social housing sector. I particularly wanted to talk to Tom because he made a little bit of a stir recently when he twice walked out of the Homes for Britain rally, which was the big social housing sector rally organised at Westminster Hall ahead of the general election campaign. I was interested in talking to Tom about his background in social housing and also the reasons why he walked out of the rally. He walked out during the speeches of both Nigel Farage and Grant Shapps. So, as Tom's based in Leicester and I'm based in Huddersfield, we conducted this interview over Skype. And it was a bit of a digital inclusion initiative as well, because it was Tom's first use of Skype, which was very good. And it all worked extraordinarily well, I have to say. Except that I did lose a little bit of the first answer that Tom gave me. So I'm just going to introduce this by saying that I began by asking Tom to fill me in with some of the details of the background to his life and career in social housing. And he began by telling me that he believes he owes his life to social housing, because he was born in a new council house in Leicester in 1952, 4 years after the advent of the NHS, and he was a breech birth. And 5 years previously, while his family were living in a slum house in Leicester, his older brother was born, also breech birth, but died at birth. So Tom firmly believes that he owes his life not only to the NHS, but to the quality of social housing that his family were able to provide in 1952 and onwards. So I'll let Tom pick up the story from there.
Nice new council house, and in 1948, my family were living in a slum, and in 1952, the National Health Service existed, and in 1948, it didn't. So I don't think it's an exaggeration. I actually put my life down to the fact that the welfare state had been created and social housing existed. So I guess social housing has just always been in my blood. My family were homeless in the 1960s, in 1965. We were homeless for 9 months. And again, it was social housing that rescued us. And a year later, Cathy Come Home was on the telly, that great play, and it almost mirrored the time we were homeless. So again, I was born and bred in social housing. I've lived in social housing almost all my life. My parents lived in social housing all their lives, and they died in social housing. All of my extended family, which is huge, live in social housing. So in a way, it was almost inevitable that I began a career in social housing in 1976 with John Perry in urban renewal in Leicester. And by good luck or chance or fortune, I eventually became the chief exec of one of the largest housing associations in the country.
You'll have seen a lot of changes over that time. I mean, what do you think are some of the key changes about social housing, and particularly, I think, the public's attitude to social housing over that time?
I think in those days, social housing was not seen as a tenancy of last resort. And I don't regard it as a tenancy of last resort, and never have. I lived on an estate. I lived on a number of estates in Leicester. They were all tough. There were times when things were uncomfortable. But we just saw it as a home. It was where we lived. And even today, my extended families just see that the social home that they live in is a home that provides them with security and stability. So I get very angry when people try to stigmatise social housing and the tenants of social housing. And I think we've seen more of that in the last few years. I think programmes like Benefit Street add to the problem. I think the way the government talks about social housing and social housing tenants add to the problem. I think the way the press publicise certain issues add to the problem. And we forget that social housing does what we all need, and that is provide us with a home.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked in a number of other countries where they don't have that stigma. And I've been on social housing estates in the Netherlands, for instance, where people have got Mercedes parked outside the house. And I've expressed surprise about it. And people have said to me, well, you know, why not? There is no stigma. It's not, as you say, it's not the tendency of last resort. I suppose that all changed in the 1980s, really, didn't it?
I think I began in social housing in 76. And even in the early 80s, people were talking about problem families in inverted commas. And I remember going to public meetings and talking to local residents that, you know, the people we were providing a home for were not problem families. They were just like them. The only difference is they needed a home because they were either homeless or living in poor conditions, or that they might have had one or two other problems. And I think when people began to experience living next to these people, they quickly discovered that they weren't demons. They were just ordinary people like you and I. So I guess there's always been a little bit of debate about problem families. I just think we've exaggerated it. We've exacerbated it. We've made it worse over the last 20 years, I guess. I mean, I know there is some residualization taking place, and I know some estates have high concentration on people on Social Security. But even in those areas where I've worked, there are some good people who want to contribute to society, just like we all do.
I remember in the 1980s, a friend of mine lived on Braunston Estate in Leicester, and he just walked into a he was a graduate, and he went to the housing office and said, have you got anywhere to live? And they said, you can move in tomorrow if you want to go to Braunston.
Yeah, and there are certain estates that have certain reputations, and I often see that estates have life cycles. If you put a lot of people with families and young children together on one estate, it will go through problems. Mm. But estates mature, they develop, and they change in their nature. I was born and bred on New Park's estate in Leicester, which is next to Braunston. In the 50s and the 60s, that estate had a reputation. In the 70s and the 80s, it had matured into something completely different. And then a new set of families move in and reputations develop. I think like all areas, estates, neighbourhoods have life cycles.
And I think these things have vicious circles, really, because I remember when I worked for Leicester City Council and I was working on Braunston Estate. It was well known that if you put your address down as Braunston Estate,
you didn't get a job.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's true of inner city areas as well, isn't it?
Mm.
And I've worked in Birmingham, and if you put Handsworth down or if you put Aston down, the chances are that people will eliminate you from the job process even before it started.
So I'm interested in what you think, because one of the things I've been doing with social housing sector is to try to get people to tell the positive stories to fight back against, you know, the benefit street and all that sort of stuff, and I'm just wondering what your views are on that.
I think it's really important that people tell the stories about people who have been provided with a home and how it's given them the foundation to develop their own lives. I would argue that my own life is one of those stories. I was born in a working class family. I was raised on a social housing estate. I went to a secondary modern school. I had the opportunity to leave school at 16 and move into a job. I left that job to go back to further education at 18. I went to university when I was 21. That would be more difficult to do today because all of it was provided by grants and the welfare state itself. And I think housing associations today have a responsibility to give the next generation the same sort of opportunities, not just by providing them with homes, but also providing other opportunities and gateways into developing their lives. And I think there are some great stories out there about what people have done and how they've done it. After the last series of social unrest in Handsworth, my own association set up a apprentice scheme for apprentices. Of those people who probably would not have been given any opportunities elsewhere. And within 12 months, 60 or 70% of those apprentices had secured a permanent job and had gone on to live more positive lives in the view of society. And I just think the whole of the social housing sector is full of examples where people have been given an opportunity, taken that opportunity and moved on. I think what you don't do is force people to do it. And I think I'm sometimes a little critical of organisations that have contracts that say that you must do this. I think our main job is still to provide a home, but I believe more than anything else that once someone has got the safety and security of a home, they can begin to build their own lives. Without a home, that's almost impossible.
Yeah, I agree. And it frustrates me when I talk to housing providers who say to me, oh, well, you can only spend money on things that benefit our tenants. And what they mean by that is something that's directly involved with the house, rather than their wider lives.
Yeah. And I think that's become more difficult in the age of austerity. I think one of the problems we now have is the traditional funding that provided real social homes and not homes that are unaffordable also provided the surpluses and the profits to invest in neighbourhoods as a whole and not just neighbourhoods that related to our own properties and our own tenancies. And I think one of the tragic results of this austerity is that not only are we're no longer allowed to provide homes that are genuinely affordable, the add-ons that we used to do become more difficult because the money is drying up. And as you know, and as most people know, when grants are cut, other charities disappear, other organisations that help local people no longer exist. The last organisation standing in many communities is either faith organisations or housing associations. And in a way, that increases our responsibility to do more at a time when we've got less.
Okay, then let's talk about Homes for Britain. So in the run-up to the Homes for Britain rally, did you have high hopes for that campaign?
As you know, I'm one of the founder members of the Shout campaign, and that stands for Social Housing Under Threat. And the two main objectives of Shout is one, to argue for higher government investment in real social housing. And I think you can still do that. I think the age of austerity should be challenged and we should be looking to governments to provide money for such a vital service, not just in housing, but in health and education and elsewhere. And I think we've accepted the austerity status quo and neoliberalism too easily. And once upon a time, housing associations would have been in the vanguard of challenging that. And today, I fear that some have just accepted it too quietly. So I've always been a bit unsure about the Homes for Britain campaign. And I was unsure of it because it tried to be all things to all people. And I think by being all things to all people, it watered down its message. I mean, solving the housing crisis in a generation is really like motherhood and apple pie. You can't argue against it, but it really doesn't say very much either. And I would want to see something much more concrete, like let's have real government investment in social housing, because that's what's needed. But in the end, I decided that as it was the election, as most people were involved, it would be churlish not to support Homes for Britain. But I did it as a critical friend, not as an outright supporter. And I think I've continued to play that role as the campaign has developed. In some ways, it's been very successful. It's been very well organised. It's been very professional. It's got lots of people involved. And at one sense, people are now talking about the sector or even a movement again. I'm not sure that's totally true, but you need to recognise that success. I just wish that success was based upon a clearer message about what we need to do to solve the housing crisis.
So you got come to the rally and you walked out twice, didn't you? I'm right.
Yeah, well, even before going to the rally, I was a little unsure about what to do because I had these views and I knew that those views would not necessarily be reflected on the platform. And what we decided to do as a group in Shout was to go together, at least take our banner along and promote our own message within the context of Homes for Britain. And on the day, that was very successful. We got a lot of support, a lot of people came to talk to us, and a lot of people said that they supported our message. My concerns increased when I heard that Farage and Grant Shapps were due to speak. In fact, when I heard that, I couldn't believe it. I have spent my life fighting racism. I believe that Farage and UKIP are a racist party. I believe they exploit the immigration message, something that I've always been strongly opposed to, and something that housing associations were actually set up to help new migrants and immigrants in the 50s and the 60s. That campaign, I think, was so successful that at one time, the National Federation of Housing Associations, or the National Housing Federation as it is now, had a policy of not allowing platforms to those people who had views that were anti-immigration or potentially racist. So I was so surprised when I heard that Farage was speaking, and for a time I just couldn't believe it. Grant Shapps, remember, was the man who had demonised the housing sector and did the things we were talking about earlier, and also withdrew the majority of our grant, which had enabled us to provide real social homes. So again, I was really disappointed to see that he was on the platform. I also read that no heckling would be allowed at the conference. I just thought that was just too stage managed. And if you remember recently, even Age Concern allowed heckling at the Prime Minister. And Age Concern isn't seen as a radical organisation. Yet our own National Housing Federation was not allowing heckling. And I just couldn't believe that. So I turned upon the day, I heard that Farage was going to speak, and I felt that the only way I could signify my protest was to walk out quietly, which I did. But what I did do was tweet that I'd walked out, and I got a lot of support. A lot of people said, who were in the audience, I wish we had walked out as well, Tom. Why do we have to sit through this racist speaker? Why has the Federation allowed that? I then wrote an article about it, which generated more debate. And many people are now saying, well, actually, the Federation probably shot themselves in the foot by inviting Farage, because the debate has been more about him being there than the Home for Britain message. It was inevitable that I'd walk out on Shapps. I dislike the man. I disagree with the man. But luckily, by then, people had warmed up and were barracking him. And that was good to hear from the outside of the conference centre. And I still think I did the right thing. I don't regret what I did. And I think the National Housing Federation did the wrong thing by inviting those two speakers to the rally. In addition, it was interesting to hear at the rally itself some great speakers. Ken Loach was there. Other people were there. And those people who got the loudest applause were those people who made the argument for public investment in social housing. So in a way, our presence was vindicated, because it seemed to me that the rank and file of the housing sector still agree with the message that you can't solve the housing crisis without huge amounts of public investment in social homes. And the only way to do that is to challenge the austerity philosophy. So I was really pleased to hear that at the conference. So I had some huge highs hearing that well received, and some huge lows by having to witness Farage and Shapps, in my view, soil the platform that was provided for them.
So have you got any thoughts on how the housing movement sector, whatever it is now, can influence the election campaign?
Well, I think there's two issues, really. One is there's the overall issue about austerity, which provides a context for cutting not just investment in housing, but investment in social security and health and in other areas that are vital to a healthy community. So I think, one, we should be challenging that more. And I think we've really been too quiet on that message. And even the Labour Party and other parties are supporting some of that message, if not all of it, in terms of their own policies reflecting the austerity context. And I just think it's time to say there is another way. You can borrow to invest, and in the long run, it saves the country money and it is better for the economy. And I don't think we're making that argument strongly enough. Purely and simply on a housing front, I read this weekend, and it's in The Guardian this morning, that 25,000 social homes have been converted to so-called affordable homes in the last year. And I think by doing that, we're almost doing the government's job for them. We're pricing out a whole generation of poor people from having decent accommodation in London. And in a way, I think we should be saying no more to the government. This policy is not helping those in the greatest need. All we're becoming is developers. And I fear that mission creep means that more housing associations are moving away from their traditional values. So I think there's two things. One is we should be saying more, we should be shouting louder, hence the Shout campaign. And two is we shouldn't be doing the government's job for them. We're making it too easy for the government to argue that the affordable housing program has been a success when it hasn't. It has housed a certain group of people, but it's enabled housing associations to move away from their traditional core values. And I fear that if we continue to do that, we will really see the slow death of social housing. And that would be a tragedy for this country.
So what are your hopes for the future of the sector then?
My hopes are more will begin to listen to the message. My fear is I will be seen as an aging dinosaur who is saying things that no one ever wants to hear anymore because the movement has changed, the sector has changed, the work we do is changing. We can still argue we're doing work that helps a certain group in need, but we're no longer helping those who were originally set up to help. So I'm optimistic in the way that I think things will change because things do change. And I look at the Greek election as a great example of that, and that gives me help. But I'm also fearful that too many organisations have already gone too far down the developer route and will go the way eventually of building societies and some banks and look what happened to them.
So would you say you generally hope, or there's a little bit of despair there, really?
No, I more see my glass as being half full. I'd rather it was full, and a nice pint of the dark stuff would go down well at the moment. But I want to believe in the future. I want to believe in the housing sector that not only provided a home for me when I was born, but also provided a home for my family when it was homeless, and has provided me with a career, a great career, for the last 40 years. So I will continue to campaign. I will continue to shout out. I will continue to hope that the government will eventually see the necessity of investing in social housing. Because if we don't, I fear what will happen to poor people in the future and who will provide them with homes. And I think it's for them that I want to continue to campaign. My life, my career is not over, but it's getting into the twilight days. And as I've written recently, I want to continue to rage against the dying of the light.